Welcome. Happy holidays, everybody, and welcome to, this is Bill Bregoli tells me, our 20th podcast of sitting around talking movies. We're going to be talking about all new movies this week. We're going to be talking about Concussion. We're going to be talking the Will Smith movie. We're going to be talking about The Hateful Eight. That's a new Quentin Tarantino film. We're going to be talking about The Revenant, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hardy. And we're going to be talking about, what's the fourth one? What's the fourth one, Bill?
Joy.
Joy. The David O. Russell movie. Thank
That's
you.
That's telling right there.
You saved the best for last. I think you saved the best for last.
Jennifer Lawrence and Robert De Niro and all the other cast of regulars that David O. Russell uses. I am joined, as always, by Bill Bregoli from CBS News Radio.
Hi there.
And Bill McCuddy, my friend and colleague.
Neil, do you always do this without a shirt? Tell the viewers at home.
And we have Mike Sargent from WBAI, and we have a new guest today, the very esteemed Jeffrey Wells from HollywoodInsider.com.
Hi, HollywoodElsewhere.com.
HollywoodElsewhere.com.
That's cool.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's so much. I couldn't even remember Joy. It's just so much information.
This is live, and we prove it every week.
I'm just overwhelmed. That's right. So anyway, let's start off with one of these four movies. Bill, pick a movie you want to start out with.
I heard the disdain in the room, so I'm going to go right for the juggler and say that Joy is one of my favorite movies of the year.
Tell everybody a little bit about what it's about.
Well, it's the fourth time that the Preston Sturges band of characters led by David O. Russell has decided to come back together for a film. And what it's about is that Hollywood is kind of gunning for this film because they don't really want David O. Russell to have this many hits in a row, in my opinion, and we can talk about that. But it's The Woman Who Invented the Miracle Mop. And when I tell people that, they just go, I don't think I want to see that movie. And I say, it is so not about a woman who invented the miracle mop and about...
Her name is Joy Mangano.
Joy, yeah.
And she's a multimillionaire. But, you know, they're denying... They're denying... and we went to a luncheon, Bill. I don't want to sound like...
Well, no, they're not... Okay, yeah.
They're not really saying it's a biopic on this woman.
No, in fact, they said they didn't want to do that, and they had to get her permission to
make it... But it's her story.
Yeah, but they specifically said, we're going to make this into a fable, which they demonstrate for the first 20 minutes with some crazy soap opera.
Well, does she have a dysfunctional family like this in real life?
In real life, I don't know.
Yeah, right. Or was that a whole David O. Russell invention?
No, I think...
He creates... salad. He throws it in the air and sees where it lands. So, you know.
What do you think of it, Mike?
You know, I like the story better than I like the movie. I thought that her story is pretty fascinating. But for me, as much as I like Jennifer Lawrence as a performer, and I think she's a really good actress, she didn't bring anything to this character. I felt like I didn't know this character any better from the beginning of the film than I did by the end of the film. I didn't really get a sense of her.
Using her own personality to sell this particular
film. What do you think of it?
Actually, going on with what Mike was saying, I thought she was a little too young for the role.
Yeah, well, the real character is 10 years older, you know?
And actually, the real one, Joy Mangano, is an executive producer. So she went along with this fable treatment.
Of course, I'd want to be portrayed as 10 years old.
I had a very weird experience with the film, is that the first half an hour of the film, I absolutely hated the movie. It just shows you the dysfunction in the family. I think Robert De Niro was over the top. He's throwing plates and busting up furniture in the house. And they keep showing scenes from a soap opera that Virginia Madsen, who plays Jennifer Lawrence's mother, who's kind of like just sits in bed and watches soap operas all day, they actually take you into the soap opera full screen. And these soap opera scenes, they keep going on and on, and they're repeated. And so the first half an hour of the film, I'm like, this is terrible. I'm going to hate this movie. Then all of a sudden, she invents this mop. Now I'm getting interested. She asks Isabella Rossellini, who's dating Robert De Niro's character, to be an investment partner in the thing. And now I'm interested. And once she gets to QVC, and Bradley Cooper enters the picture, and she starts pitching this thing, as you say, to quote you, what you said on our television show today, the movie takes off like a rocket, and I think it's great once she starts with the QVC thing. I should add, by the way, which I say every week, that this is sort of an after show to a television show that we do called Talking Pictures on Demand, New York One in New York, and locally, and Time Warner Cable nationally.
After 20 episodes, I think everyone knows that. By the way, I would ask all our listeners, do you remember where you were on our first?
Did you like it, Jeffrey?
Yes, I liked it, but I wasn't rocket fuel like it was
I didn't think it took life.
It was an appealing thing, but it's odd that they don't mention the word miracle mop in the entire film.
Yeah, that's true. Well, maybe there's a copyright on that or something. She wants to invent a mop,
but she was the exec producer. How could she not have the rights to her own property.
Yeah, that's a good
Can
question.
Can I ask you guys, what did you think of... I'm sorry.
Are you going to say Melissa Rivers as Joan?
Yes.
Were you? Really?
Yes, I was.
I was really impressed with the fact that
well,
she...
Well, why don't you explain that? Right, she goes on QVC, as we all know, Joan Rivers was a big QVC personality, hawking jewelry and other products on there. Mm-hmm. And Melissa Rivers is... imitating her mother, Joan Rivers.
But not in this cartoony, over-the-top kind of, can we talk kind of a thing, but like almost like I imagine Joan, you know, we knew her from the red carpet and stuff, and she was a little over-the-top in person, but I think as a regular person, the way only her daughter would know her, she wasn't. And, you know, she has a couple of moments where she's telling the Joy character what she should wear, but I thought it was really good. I thought she was great.
Well, wouldn't you rather see Melissa Rivers play Joan Rivers than another actress that they get to come in?
No, I thought that was a booking coup.
I completely agree with you about the film begins. It really starts to happen when the mop...
When the mop comes, right, the mop comes
into
play.
It never really takes off.
I agree with you, once they get to QVC.
I think it was good. I think it was solid, but I never felt it took off like a rocket. I never felt it got into the stratosphere. I thought it was solid, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about the very beginning. The very, very, very first scene in the movie is Susan Lucci playing Danica, this... And as luck would have it, minutes before I met you gentlemen here today, I was talking to her. And believe me, she was very pumped that she got to be the first person seen in the movie in the very first scene.
So I just saw it for the first time a week ago at the world premiere. I had not seen it at all. And I will tell you that I was just completely surprised to see that Danica opens the movie. That was, I mean, so surprising to me.
Well, you know, I like the fact that they cast all these, you know, daytime and nighttime soap opera actors in this, you know, sort of fantasy soap world. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, the Falcon Crest people show up on Dynasty
people. I agree. Jeffrey and I are on the street. I hated that soap opera stuff in the beginning. I'm like, I don't even know what's going on in this movie. And then all of a sudden, I mean, it's very rare that I see a movie that I absolutely detest the first half an hour of the movie, and then I actually love the end of the movie.
So you were advised people to go on Fandango, look at the start time, add 20 minutes and show up.
I say you just endure. I think it's a really interesting movie. I think you just got to endure the first half an hour of the movie, and then it becomes...
It's a lot of setup.
And I want to give a quick plug to Diane Ladd, who plays the grandmother, Mimi, and is sort of the voice and soul of this movie. She didn't know. We had lunch with her the other day, as you alluded to a second ago. She didn't know she was going to be the narrator. They cut the film together, and then David Russell called her back in, and she became the narrator of the film. And she is really the heart and soul of this thing, and really sort of casts a mini little spell over it that takes the narration away from the Joy character, and I think is valuable in that way. I think it adds a lot to the film.
I won't spoil the end of the movie, but I will say towards the end of the movie, it just kind of reminds me of an episode of Shark Tank, what goes on in the end of the film. And I'll say that it's not David O. Russell's finest work. I don't think it's up there with Silver Linings Playbook or The Fighter or even American Hustle, but I still think it's worthwhile to see just plow through the first 30 minutes. And
I think it's better than American Hustle.
Neil, you really loved Silver Linings Playbook?
I liked it.
I really loved it. Yeah.
You didn't like Silver Linings Playbook?
I thought Silver Linings Playbook, to me, the only thing that made that movie work is that you got Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence playing the kind of roles that Sandra Bullock and what's his name? Always plays.
Matthew McConaughey?
No, not Matthew McConaughey.
Come on.
He's in...
Sandra Bullock is...
Oh, no, come on. He always does these type of movies. He always plays the nebbishy kind, but he's good-looking and women.
Oh, Ryan Reynolds.
No, not even.
I'm sorry. We're going to have to flip all the cards.
Flip all the cards and tell him.
Thanks for playing. And please accept the home game version of sitting around talking movies. He's been a great contestant in The Marvelous Guest.
By the way, security is here now. You're going to be asked to leave the building for the Silver Lining Playbook song.
All right. Well, anyway, let's move on to... let's talk
Hateful
about...
Hateful Eight.
What's that?
Hateful Eight.
Let's do Hateful Eight. Sure. Let's do Hateful Eight.
It's the lightning round where guests get to call out any movie.
You'll look at Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic. I'm sure you guys check that out right now.
All right. Well, Jeffrey, since you want to talk about Hateful Eight, can you tell the audience briefly what the movie is about?
Yes, it's Reservoir Dogs meets Django Unchained.
With an intermission.
Yes, with an intermission. Well, and some really nice cinematography.
Because if you were hoping that a three-hour movie could be any longer, Quentin Tarantino has said, sure, I'll put a 10-minute intermission in the middle. It'll go longer.
Well, it's three
and an overture.
To summarize it, It takes place, I don't know, I guess several, a few years after the Civil War has ended, and it's Wyoming, and they're stuck in a blizzard. Kurt Russell, who plays his character called, who's the hangman, and he's transporting Jennifer Jason Leigh. He's a bounty hunter to some town, Red Rock, to collect a fee, and, you know, and...
$10,000, which was like $5.2 million
he's bringing her to be hung for her.
Right, to be hung, and they all get stuck in a cabin because of a blizzard. Him, Kurt Russell, Walton Goggins, who's claiming to be the sheriff of Red Rock, who's on his way to this town to become the new sheriff of the town. And once they get to this cabin, which is sort of a haberdashery place,
it's not really a cabin. It's like a gymnasium.
Yeah, was it Minnie? Was it Minnie's place?
Yeah, Minnie's haberdashery.
Right. There's other characters in there that include, Tim Roth, and I could bet money that role was written for Christoph Waltz, the accent and everything. Yep. He must have been not available to Christoph Waltz because it seemed like someone was doing
Bond.
Christoph Waltz. And Michael Madsen's in it, and a whole bunch of two other guys. And,
Bruce Dern's
in there, that's true. And, I have to tell you,
Before you say what you think, what's the Metacritic and what's the consensus right now?
Mid-80s. That's pretty high.
Yeah, that's good.
Not great, but that's pretty good.
Did you like the movie?
Didn't like the last third at all. I don't think anybody.
Well, that's what you're waiting for.
Can like the last third of this movie. It is really cruel and vicious, and it doesn't seem to be motivated by anything primal or really that matters. It's all just fetishy, you know. People are brutalized and killed, particularly Jennifer Jason Leigh. She has a climax that's not very, it's horrific, really, you know.
What did you think, Bregoli?
In a word, too talky. I nodded off about a third of the way through and woke up when they wound up in Minnie's place. And then they just bored me to tears, frankly. I'm tired of characters who sound like the screenwriter who wrote the thing rather than real people.
You know, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter's review, and I really like his stuff. Todd McCarthy, is it? Who said nobody talked this much in the Old West? I mean, like they just didn't. I mean, look at Revenant. There's like four words of dialogue.
We'll get to that.
But this is if you like Quentin Tarantino, there's a lot of Quentin Tarantino here. But I agree that it's not his best role. I don't think it's anywhere near as good as Django or Inglourious Basterds.
Well, pardon the pun here, but I'm in the minority. Obviously here, but I actually like this film, and for me, Tarantino's hit or miss. You know, I hated Death Proof. I feel like he should write a play and just get it out of his system. I think, you know, those movies were just all talk. For me, this movie was the first time I felt that it wasn't just talk. We got to learn about the characters. I wasn't bored. I liked what he was trying to do. I enjoyed having the intermission. I enjoyed the whole setup because I love spaghetti westerns. Wow. I liked what he was doing. I liked where it was going. I liked the suspense. I liked the twists. This is a movie, to me, the best thing he's done in about 15 years.
Okay, I couldn't disagree more. Quentin Tarantino is my favorite contemporary director. I love Pulp Fiction. I love Inglourious Basterds. I love Django Unchained. I even love Jackie Brown, and I love the Kill Bill movies. This movie seems to be a real... First of all, it's forced. A lot of the dialogue here is... It seems like he's trying to top himself. There's a scene, a big monologue, which is supposed to be shocking, that Samuel L. Jackson gives. Did we mention that Samuel L. Jackson is the star of the movie? I was naming all the people in the film. Samuel L. Jackson.
Two other guys turned out to be Bruce Dern
right.
and Samuel
like
L. Jackson.
Samuel Jackson, the star of the movie. And, you know, there's a scene, which I'm not going to tip it off, where Samuel Jackson tells a whole story about how he...
humiliates, basically.
How he humiliates, Bruce Dern's son. And it seems to me that Quentin Tarantino is trying to write a scene that is going to kind of... I'm going to top myself with that monologue in Pulp Fiction that Samuel L. Jackson gives at the beginning of the film.
Christopher Walken gives in the about the watch.
Oh, yeah. It just didn't quite work for me. And it's the 3-hour running time. I don't think it... First of all, it's filmed in 70 millimeter. And since the second half of the thing takes place all in one room, it could have been a play. And I don't think you really need 70 millimeter. I mean, it could have been a play. I'm not that invested in the characters. It's the first time in any Tarantino film where I really am not invested. I don't really care what happens. There's a flashback towards the end where they go, okay, here's the real story of what's going on. And he's doing this time shift shifting device that he sort of did in Pulp Fiction, but where it worked brilliantly in Pulp Fiction, it doesn't really work for me here. And, you know, there's an overture. He's trying to do Sergio Leone, like Once Upon a Time, you know, in America, or Once Upon a Time in the West. And it just doesn't quite gel for me. I mean,
you mentioned a stage play. I just have to jump in and ask, did you go a year ago, Jeffrey, when they did the reading at LACMA in L.A.?
Downtown L.A.
And how did that work?
Did it feel like a play at the reading?
My review of the play was pretty much exactly the review of the film.
Did seeing the reading of the play, even though we all didn't like the film except for Mike, did it? Since you knew what was going to happen, did it ruin the experience of seeing the movie?
There was a lot more brutality in the film. But otherwise, it's still kind of...
Did they act it out, or they just sat there and just read scripts?
Yeah, they act it out. But the most enjoyable part was that he would stop the play every now and then and say, hold on, and then he would give them individual directions and say, let's redo it again. That was a lot of fun.
And it was the same cast
that we see on the screen. Only Tarantino could get away. No, it wasn't the same cast, exactly.
No, it wasn't Jennifer Jason Leigh. It was... No, I'm forgetting. It'll come back.
Henderson?
Amber Tamblyn. No.
And it seems, if I'm not mistaken, and you cover this territory pretty well, the script was leaked originally, and he wasn't going to make the movie.
Yeah, he got pissed off.
And then he decided that, okay, not only are you going to make the movie now, I'm going to do a reading, and the reading is an outgrowth of the fact that the script leaked online. Is that true?
More or less.
Yeah, but you know, can I say something else about this film that I liked about it? That
sure, say whatever you want.
Not after your Silver Linings Playbook, fine. No, go ahead.
I went, and Bill was there at the press conference for this film. He talked about one of the things and one of the reasons he wanted to make this film is, you know, I've seen lots of Westerns, and one thing that Westerns never deal with, and as a person of color, it's bothered me, and that's race. And it was a big issue. It was a big issue in this country. It was a big issue in the West, and he does. And I thought that added a dimension that I never seen a Western. Like he did with Django, you know, to some extent, but I really...
Django
was a satisfying revenge film.
I thought this film dealt with a lot of issues, you know, of the time, a lot of the politics of the time, to me, that resonated with me. So I love the Sam Jackson character. I completely understood why he did what he did with the Lincoln letter. Made perfect sense to me. I understood where he was coming from. And I really thought there was more to this. I thought he was being subversive. I think there was more to this than meets the eye.
On the positive side, I liked Walton Goggins. He's never shined as much in a movie.
He's the best thing.
Right, that as he has here. And, you know, there are, I mean, even though it's long, you know, I didn't hate the movie. It's
Isn't
okay.
This the best there thing are, Jennifer there Jason are, Leigh has done in like 15 years?
I wasn't that bowled over by Jennifer Jason Leigh's performance, but I'll tell you that
a lot of people
there
are
some nuggets in the thing. It wasn't, I mean, I've seen a lot worse. It's okay. I guess I just expect more from Tarantino. And Django and Glorious Bastards and Pulp Fiction, and I can go on and on, are so much more satisfying than this that it's disappointment. Maybe if this was an unknown director and I didn't walk in with such anticipation, I would have said, okay, this is, you know, maybe I would have felt a little kinder towards it, but it's just that I expect such greatness from Tarantino writing-wise and story-wise.
So I assume now we're going to compare this to The Revenant, but before we wind this up, I want to ask a question, and does anybody know this? I mean, at first this was just going to be a road show, 100 cities, 100 retrofitting, Weinstein paying to put these projectors in. Then I find out the other day at this
press conference,
no, it's going to be released as digital, and it's going to be seen, you know, in regular theaters that can accommodate it. So
and they're going to cut out the intermission.
That's what I want to know. Is there an overturn and intermission, Jeffrey, as far as you know? And I'm trying to put you on the spot, but
I know that they've cut out the intermission for the digital.
Yeah.
About 147 minutes.
Right. That makes sense. Because
I just read somebody else is inspired by this, and they're going to release their movie in 70 millimeter now. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
It was on IMDb.
Does that all take place in a room also? Maybe it's Room. Maybe they're going to redo Room.
But here's the irony. I am so worshipful of 70 millimeter cinematography. I love the idea of ultra Panavision being brought back.
I agree with you.
But it just doesn't knock you out visually. It's nice. It's well lighted. It's professionally done. There's nothing wrong with it. But in terms of real knockout, you're talking about Emmanuel Lubezki's cinematography for The Revenant. That is absolutely.
That should have. Now, you tell me that 70 millimeter.
Can I say something,
Neil?
Okay. On the point you made, and I think maybe this is why maybe I enjoyed it. See, I don't hold Tarantino in the reverence that you do. I was so disappointed with Death Proof that I skipped Inglourious Basterds.
Well,
Death Proof doesn't count.
Death Proof. I agree with Bill. Death Proof. Because Death Proof is two movies. One directed by Robert Rodriguez,
right.
And
right.
The other one, and
which I loved.
And they're just basically, you know, a.
That was a goof. That was an exercise. That was a goof.
Tribute, homage. I don't even count that as a real Tarantino. It would be like counting.
I'd still be paying money.
He did a short film.
It was called Grindhouse. That was the one that had two or three.
Yeah, right. Grindhouse.
Two.
Death Proof was just Tarantino.
Yes.
It had two. The version came out later.
Right. The Grindhouse had two movies and an extended trailer for Machete.
I agree with you, McCuddy. That's an exorcist. I don't even count that into the canon, really, of the Tarantino. But I mean,
I think it was an excuse for he and Rodriguez to work together. Also, they had talked about it. It's South by West by Southwest
you love
thing.
Kill Bill 1 and 2.
I love 2, and I liked 1. 1 sets up 2. 2 is great.
No, you know what? I'm going to disagree with you. I tell people who haven't seen both of them to watch 2 first, because I think it works better. It's funnier because it travels backwards.
Nobody has seen, by the way, Hateful Eight. Just to make a reference for people who are listening to this who have not, but have probably seen Inglourious Basterds. Mm-hmm. It has one of the most hateful scenes I've ever seen in my life in any film, and that's when they've got the German officer, who's not necessarily a Nazi.
I've never seen
him. He's a German officer. He's a soldier.
In Hateful Eight?
No, in Inglourious Basterds. And the thing is, they want him to reveal where his company is. Where's your guys? We want to, you know. And he won't tell them. And he, in other words, he does the stand-up thing. He does the brave thing.
Right.
And his payoff is that he gets beaten to death with a baseball bat. And we're supposed to kind of like, yeah, well, that's what they deserve.
See,
they're Nazis.
But
it's okay because it was Brad Pitt. No, it wasn't. It was Eli Roth.
Donnie the Bear Jew.
Eli Roth. Yeah. Yeah.
There were two scenes in Inglourious Basterds. The first one where the guy is hiding the Jewish people under the floorboards, and Christoph Waltz comes in. Yeah. What an unbelievable! I mean, talk about knowing how to write a scene. That's just incredibly tension filled. And there's another incredible scene in that film when the Melanie Laurent character is in a cafe with Christoph Waltz, and she doesn't know whether Christoph Waltz's character knows it's her or not, who was one of those people that was hiding under the floorboards, one of the Jewish part of the family, and he keeps putting whipped cream on the thing, and it's just the camera keeps going to
Tarantino overwrites everything, and as I said about Inglourious Basterds, the reason I thought it worked so well is because when he overwrites, but it's creating tension because there's something else happening that you just can't wait for the bomb to go off, let's say, then it works great. I don't think that happens enough in Hateful Eight. There's a big secret in Hateful Eight about who's helping who, but it doesn't build the tension.
All right, let's move on to The Revenant. Bill, take it away.
Well, The Revenant is basically what I think is Leonardo DiCaprio's Oscar. It's he's in the wilderness. He is left for dead by Tom Hardy. He claws his way out. He bear claws his way out. And as somebody said, they saw him at Dunkin' Donuts buying a bear claw. That was Roger Friedman, I think. And we'll pause for no laughter. And then he's for 2.5 hours crawling across this gorgeous...
Stumbling. He's got a cane.
Yeah, he's got a little help. To find Tom Hardy and extract his revenge. His son was killed in front of him, and then he's believed killed and left for dead. I thought it was great. I think it's one of the 10 best movies of the year. I think it's stunning to look at. I know the story is very simple, but as I said about the Hateful Eight, there's like 5 lines of dialogue in this thing, 5 words. I think it works amazingly well.
The mark of a truly profound film is always when it gets better every time you see it. I've seen it 4 times.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, after the first time, I was not terribly delighted with a lot of it. I felt it was difficult. I felt it was strenuous. It was like...
interesting.
But the second time, third time, it gets better. I swear to God. It's a masterpiece. It's going to be...
I want Bregoli to check in, and then I'm going to tell you something.
Okay. Well,
I don't like
it. I was wondering,
film.
Jeffrey, when you were watching it... what I want to see over again is some of the photography in the very beginning when they were being attacked by Indians, and that camera just goes everywhere. I'm amazed how they did that stuff. My only nit to pick with the film is I don't think the characters were all that well developed, frankly. Tim,
he's not doing his conventional thing where you get to know characters.
No, I understand that, but he's the bad guy is just bad. He's just sort of one note bad, though. But other than that, I love the bear, and
I disagree with that. I think the bad guy is surviving. I think everybody is just surviving, and I don't think there's a lot of venom in him. when he kills the kid and leaves Leo for, I think it's just about getting the pelts back to the people who are going to pay them and
being killed by Indians.
Do
you want to check? I have a lot to say about this. Do you want to check first?
Well, first of all, I think that it's the filmmaking is just stupendous. It's so well shot, so well staged. The camera work is just, it's amazing.
And again, this is digital.
It's digital. It's an amazing piece of filmmaking. Okay, I think Tom Hardy practically steals the movie from DiCaprio, though I think DiCaprio is really, really, really trying hard to get an Oscar. And I think he's like, I'll do anything, you know. So, but I do feel that at the end of the day, now I'm interested because I want to watch it again now. You're saying this. At the end of the day, the story's kind of silly. The story is kind of simple. It's kind of silly. There's so many, in my opinion, holes in the story. I think it's irresponsible. You know, like, it's like, okay, I'm going to bring a little black kid with me to the Klan get-together. It's kind of ridiculous, okay? You know, I thought that it's not DiCaprio's fault that he looks so young, okay, so that his son kind of, they almost look like contemporaries as opposed to
father. Yeah, you said that on the show today. I don't agree with that at all.
No, he said that.
I said that. I'm waiting for all of you to check in, and then I'm going to tear this thing apart like a bear.
I have issues. I mean, I do agree with Bill Bregoli that the characters were not that well developed. You know, I think it's a bit of a stretch to say, oh, he's not going for character development. Okay, but, you know, you could have a little bit of more of a nuanced character to get understand, but yes, you know, Tom Hardy, all he cares about is making money with pelts. Who knows pelts were worth that much money? You're just going to kill people for them.
So let's talk about Concussion now.
At the end of the day, it's a film totally worth seeing, especially on the big screen. That's
okay, so it's 2.5 hours to tell a really simple story.
Just to be clear, you've only seen it once, right?
Yeah, but I want to talk, after I tell you my opinion, I want to ask Jeffrey what made him want to go back and see this again, but let me tell you my opinion first.
I do want to see it again.
Okay, the guy is left for dead, and he's out for revenge. I mean, that's the story, and it takes 2.5 hours. I mean, DiCaprio, you know, I'm not giving any spoilers away here. There's this bear that mauls him and attacks him. It's like, you know, and you see blood spurting and skin being ripped off the flesh and bones cracking, and it goes on for 10 minutes. I mean, look at your watch and count 10 minutes. Do you know how long of an amount of time that is?
I wasn't looking at my watch.
And it's just unbelievable. Oh, and then the bear goes away, and you take a sigh of relief, and DiCaprio is like in tatters, like in pieces, and then the bear comes back for round two, and then it's another 5 minutes of this thing. And is it well done? I mean, can I say, like, my God, I've never seen that on screen before about it. It really looked realistic. I don't know if it's done with a guy in a bear suit dressed in a green screen thing, or I don't know how they did it, but is it well done? Sure, but can I recommend anybody to, oh, you gotta see this and see DiCaprio get ripped to shreds by a bear. Who could recommend something like this? Well, you know, I mean, you said you've watched this thing
if you say unbearable, we're all gonna leave.
I'm not saying unbearable.
I know what you're talking about. DiCaprio reaction was somewhat similar to mine. I was going, this is too much. This is not pleasant. This is arduous, but I'll tell you, when you get past the shock of that and you see how well it's done, it's so immersive. It's so completely
real.
It is
immersive.
It's amazing. It's
on real,
another
level. But like, can you actually say this? Oh, you've got to just watch this 15-minute violence, and then there's another scene with a horse that's also not as disgusting as the bear, but not as violent as the bear, but kind of disgusting on its own level. Listen, I think that also they have the son.
Okay,
DiCaprio has a son in this, who's a half a Pawnee. And, you know, they look to me similar in age. So when he's going, my son, you're my son, I'm thinking, is this really his son? Is it metaphorical? Going, you are my brother.
I thought he looked like he was 12 or 13.
No, I think he looked like he was the same age, you know? Yeah. And there's very little dialogue, as you said, McCuddy. I mean, because the bear incapacitates DiCaprio's ability to speak for a substantial part of the film. So he's just grunting and making noise, you know, like this, you know what I mean? The screenplay in terms of dialogue must have only filled up a couple of pages. Is it shot well? Yes. Is it well done for what it is? Yes, but I cannot fully understand. So I ask you, Jeffrey, really, like, why would what case could you make to say you must see this particular movie? I mean, to me, it's just a simple story dragged out and overly disgustingly violent.
It really is something to say you've never seen or felt quite the way you do when you watch this film. You've never seen anything this well rendered.
I agree with that.
You know what the analogy is? This doesn't make it won't sound sensible to you, but it's like The Shining. The Shining was not greeted with great hosannas when it came out. It was like, eh, you know, not bad. You kind of missed it. It keeps going because people believe it. There's something profoundly immersive about that film. You feel
the madness in the hallways. But The Shining had all these little cute nuggets, like when Jack Nicholson is working for like the whole movie, and then all of a sudden you see it's all work and no play, and it's written in a pyramid. It's written double space. I mean, there's all these fun little nuggets, and you know, the kid on the big wheel bike with the blood. It's just.
So you'd have liked a typewriter in The Revenant, but they didn't exist.
No, I'm just saying that. Listen, I agree with you that Tom Hardy gives a great performance, Mike. You know, but
it's long because he doesn't have a car. And it takes a long time to get across the wilderness.
200 miles.
I can't spoil this, but I'll say that the captain, you know, that he when he goes out alone, that he doesn't bring a regiment with him at one particular point,
is
just ridiculously unrealistic.
At the very end, you're saying.
Yes. I mean, you're going to go out. You have 150 people. I'm going out alone. You know what I mean? It just doesn't make. It doesn't make any sense. It's so stupid. But that said, for what it is, yes, it's well done, but I can't see the point in seeing this one. What made you, before we move on, what made you, you said you've seen this movie four times, which is like astounding to me. And you had a similar view of me to me the first time you saw the movie, to some extent.
Yeah.
Okay, so what made you go back and see this again?
Do you see it with other people?
I know that Lubezki is a masterful cinematographer.
So you were looking at it from a cinematography
and
standpoint.
And I really respect Inarritu. I know that he's up to...
Because we never mentioned that. It is directed, through this whole thing, it is directed by Alejandro.
Gonzalez Inarritu.
Yeah, Inarritu, who directed Birdman last year and did Babel. You think he did Babel? Yeah.
Can 21 grams.
I want to add, in support of what Jeffrey's saying, it is incredibly immersive, and in many ways, it is a filmic experience that you really haven't had before. You know, I think that the brutality of it with the bear and whatnot, it kind of works because you felt like you went through something. So you're kind of with the character after it's like you're in the aftermath of the sequence. There's one sequence in there where they're being attacked and he goes off a cliff. And I got to tell you,
on a horse.
On a horse.
On a
and
horse.
I literally said, whoa, in the theater when it happened. Because it was so, like, stunning to me.
It's like if Thelma.
No idea how they
it's
did.
Like if Thelma and Louise had been on a horse.
There's two kinds of good film. The kind you like and you tell your friends, you got to see it. You'll really like it. Mm-hmm. And then there's the kind that you talk about with increasing respect 5, 10, 20 years later. This is one of those.
You think this holds up better than Birdman 10 years from now, for example? To
maybe
compare two completely different Inarritu films.
I don't know.
Can I put you on the spot for a second,
it's
too?
Like because a snuff film.
Because you tweeted out some stuff about you went with a woman who or you saw it with
and I got murdered on Twitter for
saying this may not be for women.
I said, forget women seeing this.
Well, on what? On Revenant?
Revenant, yeah.
Interesting.
And then I was also told, after that whole Twitter thing happened, by a guy who's a producer and a producer's rep, he says, listen, unsolicited, I know three guys who have told me the same thing. Their girlfriends and their wives will not be able to take this movie.
No, yeah.
You know? But I got killed, and I was literally stabbed to death on Twitter for saying this, because under 35 X-Factor women... you know, despise the idea that they're delicate creatures and they can't handle this. You know, well, I'm not saying that they're not going to handle it.
I think it depends on the woman. I think some women are
women
like,
right
I don't think
in
it's
the
gender specific.
A good friend who's a DP who really knows her stuff. She's going like this.
Right.
Oh, she was in a fetal position.
The film. She was in a fetal.
For those of you who aren't in the room here with us. For the record, Mrs. McCuddy loved Revenant. Did Mrs. Rosen see it?
My wife would not be able to watch a film like this. My wife, when we saw at a press screening of Reservoir Dogs, walked out at the famous ear scene.
Right.
She walked out. She doesn't like looking at when we go. But that's her. I mean, I don't think it's gender specific. I mean, if Lisa Rossman, who does our television show, was here, she would tell you the same thing. I think there are some women that would probably dig it, and some people that wouldn't like it. And, you know. I don't know.
Neil, pick up line one. It's your wife saying, don't speak for me. Okay.
All right. So let's the last movie, Concussion, the Will Smith movie. I'll tell you what this is about. This is about, it's based on a true story about a guy by the name of Dr. Bennett Omalu. And he's from Nigeria, and he was an accomplished pathologist. And he's the one that brought to light to the NFL this he had to name it, actually. It was, he calls it CTE, which, you know, the, all these players were suffering from, they thought it was early onset Alzheimer's, but in reality, it was these concussions that these,
repeated
concussions that these football players in the NFL were experiencing that was causing them to, I don't know, Mike, help me out.
Well, basically, they had been hit in the head so many times that they were literally losing their minds.
Yeah, and the movie starts out with David Morse, who's such a great actor, by the way.
Always.
And he plays a real-life Pittsburgh center Hall of Famer, Mike Webster. And, you know, he's, like, loved by the town of Pittsburgh. He's a hero. Some people say he's the greatest center to ever play the game. And he's homeless, and he's a mess. And you know, nobody knows what's wrong with him. But, it's again, it's from being repeatedly hit in the head. And then there's another player who's also loved, that was, you know, a hometown favorite. And Will Smith plays this guy, and you know, Bregoli is. You spoke to Will, didn't you?
Well, he did a press conference, and actually, just going back to David Morse real quick, I haven't got a soundbite of it, but I remember him talking about the makeup that they put on him to play that character. They actually added to his forehead because the guy had so much scar material built up that they had to
kind of like Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did Will Smith have any makeup on, by the way? Like, because he didn't.
I don't think so.
My wife kept saying he doesn't really look exactly like Will Smith or something like that. I don't know.
Maybe it's just the way he.
That's just amazing.
Did he
you know, Will Smith is a craftsman.
I don't know.
It's interesting. At the press conference, Will Smith was there, and the doctor he plays was there, and actually, they had different accents.
Oh, really?
Will Smith's accent in the movie was different than the real Dr. Benedict.
Well, I have some Nigerian friends that Will Smith's Nigerian accent is laughable.
Yeah. Really?
They
I know a Deadline guy who has a Nigerian employee in that office, and she said the same thing.
Yeah.
But he sounded okay to my ears.
To my ears, to my American ears, he sounded, you know.
Well, I think I have some problems with the movie, and we'll get into that. But I thought Smith, his character oozes charisma. Mm. You know, he's just like, he's a coroner, and I like the way these dead bodies come in, and he's like, they're dead. He's like, talk to me. We're in this together. We're going to figure out what happens here. You know, it's kind of
Will Smith using charisma is a real envelope pusher. But what did he talk about at the conference?
We asked him if he looks at football differently since he's done this movie.
For me, I haven't watched a game this season. I'm not avoiding it. I've seen, you know, been walking by in an airport or something like that and see plays. But you can't not see the repetitive subconcussive blows.
And then he went on to actually praise the players, though.
It's double-sided. It makes it a much more elaborate sport for me now, right? So I'm seeing so many more things than I ever saw. And it also makes me respect the guys that much more.
It's a very formulaic movie. It's almost like a made-for-TV movie. It's like a made-for-TV movie with a big budget and big stars. It's a very important topic. I mean, parents should see it so their kids don't go into junior league football, so they should know what they're getting into, because these things really, I mean, just came out that Frank Gifford, you know, who just passed away, you know, suffered from the effects of this. And the NFL did change some rules. It did remind me at times, and although they do address this later on in the film, I'm going, this is like the cigarette companies. They had the findings, and they knew this was causing damage, and the cigarette companies, no, it doesn't cause cancer. And it's like, no, this isn't.
But we've had, football has been with us for, 100,
at least,
almost 100 years. Has this been going on for almost that time?
And look at those little helmets. If you watch the old stuff,
the old
from
leather
helmets. if you watched
leather necks,
or watch horse feathers with the Marx Brothers,
right.
You're wearing these little they're almost like baseball.
Well, I'm sure
caps.
Horse feathers did it very accurately.
The equipment is accurate.
I gotta believe when you wore those little leather. I don't remember leather necks well enough, but I gotta believe they didn't try and hit each other in the head when they were.
That's exactly what Bob Costas told me.
Oh, really?
I saw him at the American Cinematheque.
Well, that's interesting.
And he said that if they were wearing those leather jackets, they would probably avoid what they are doing now, because they believe,
right,
or they've been told,
right,
that they can just ram like a goat,
right,
and get away with it. And he says that probably would be a solution.
But don't you remember a couple, when this whole thing story broke, I remember that the NFL designed a bigger helmet. It was this huge helmet. And they showed it to you, and they showed it to you in relation to the size of the standard Riddell helmets that are being worn now. And they tried wearing them for like one game, and everybody laughed and said, "This is ridiculous." And
I don't remember that. I mean,
yeah,
that
and they silly. And they went back to the old helmets. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they did that.
That vindicated them. That's all they had to do. Play one game with the big helmet.
They didn't use the big helmets, but it's like, why not ensure extra safety?
They look like Mel Brooks in Spaceballs.
Well, if you look at, yeah, that was the thing. They look ridiculous. Well, I'm sure these helmets look ridiculous compared to the leather things, you know? I don't know, but they seem to get rid of them. But,
you know, the thing for me on this movie is it doesn't have a hard enough edge. I wish Peter Berg had directed it or somebody that would have given it a little, or Oliver Stone, because the material is ripe. And, I mean, there's a lot of pounding of heads, so the movie literally does hit you over the head. But I thought that nothing but good things happens to this guy. You know, it's like he doesn't have a girlfriend, so this gorgeous woman moves in with him and suddenly that he's forced to live with. They come and they he's his mentor or friend is Albert Brooks, who's so good in the movie. And
did he shave his head for
but
the
they
movie,
come in,
by the
they
way?
Come, the
or is
IR,
he really bald?
No, I think he's gone bald. Well, anyway, they come in. They come in to arrest him. And instead of him getting mad at Will Smith, he's like, "Oh, I'm so glad they didn't arrest you, Will Smith." I mean, it's like nothing. That's the hallmark.
What did you say on the TV show on Talking Pictures?
Well,
you said something about
the
guy.
My thoughts on the film was this. I think it's a very important subject. And I think I'm glad the movie was made. And I respect all the people who are involved with the film. Problem I have with the film is that they took this important story and made it so formulaic that it seems like almost like a TV movie. And Will Smith's character is so flawless. You know, he's like more flawless than Will Smith. And I felt that made it hard to relate. I mean, it just became like, yes, he's forced to live with this African girl, but it's the most beautiful girl, black girl working in Hollywood now. They cast her.
Mbatha
Raw.
Who was great.
I agree with what you said about
movie,
Albert Brooks. It's
Bell,
like everybody's so good natured. Everybody's so, and all these good things. He's up against this really powerful organization, but we don't, you know, it's really kind of toned down. There.
Really nice fantasy
no.
when she
it
came
was,
in. You know?
Yeah,
have you ever known a really beautiful woman to be that easy? and agreeable
all the time.
And supportive.
If I said yes, I'd be sued.
Yeah, right,
but
exactly.
Yeah,
that's what hurt the film. I thought Will Smith does a good job. He's solid. I don't think necessarily Oscar worthy, but this is not a year.
Is he Golden Globe worthy? He's absolutely going to get a Golden Globe.
Nominated and
anybody can get a Golden Globe. Well, Madonna won the Golden Globe for her performance in Evita.
Shatner won a Golden Globe.
Pia Zadora. She bought it.
Yeah, Pia Zadora.
Yeah, well, you can go. That's a whole other conversation.
So
the voting body of the Golden Globe, the Hollywood Foreign Press.
But I agree with you. It would have been better if it was directed by somebody who had an edge, who didn't give an F about what the NFL or anybody else.
There's really no solution also. You know, to
right.
Have them
yeah, that,
I know
that's a very good point, Jeffrey.
Football. There's no... Yeah. Well, what are you supposed to do? To
you know,
it?
I was looking for her at the end. Like, I actually asked... Robert Wall, who's a friend to this podcast, who played Arliss, the famous sports agent for many seasons on HBO, and I said, "Well, you know, were any changes made after this came out?" And he actually said, "Yeah, they changed some rules in the NFL, and if somebody is a concussion, but this should have been a thing at the end of the at the end of the movie, saying since 2011 or whatever it is, the NFL, but, right, absolutely right, Jeffrey. There's no explanation."
Well, and there's also no. You're watching this movie, unlike any other movie, going, I wonder if this does get solved, because I lived watched the news and I don't remember any of this. So you're like, what the hell happened? You brought the big helmet story up, like Gnu or whatever his name was on the Flintstones, but I didn't remember.
Wow, what a reference. I actually know what you're talking about.
I didn't remember any of this happening. And then so I thought, well, what's the payoff going to be? And the payoff is, well, they sort of acknowledge it and they're trying to do something better. But in the meantime, these guys are...
Well, the fact that Robert Wall is telling me, they were these changes, they did this and that. Don't you think the movie could have like mentioned that, or at least put the type at the end of at the end of the screen, since then blah 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 blah, like the end of Spotlight,
where
they tell you how
because,
many...
No, I'll bet you it's because the Will Smith character didn't have that much with what happened thereafter, and
it's
was
also
taken
there
out
were,
of him.
There are these melodramatic moments that are just like the wife thinks she's being chased, and that really goes nowhere.
You know what's interesting? I interviewed the director and I asked him about what his decision, what he decided to cut out, and what was there. And there were things that he said he cut out that I think, like, for instance, this doctor had a cousin that played in football. And, you know, they had shot it and everything, but then they decided that it didn't fit in the movie. And that would have given me a little more of an understanding of why he pursued this, opposed to being like, Quincy, you know, I got to solve this murder, you know. And
you know, Will Smith was more scenes with my wife.
So I think that there were a lot of things they could have done. But I want to ask all you gentlemen here, what's your prediction? I mean, a movie, as you know, as we all know, can actually influence.
I don't think Concussion is getting any Academy Award nominations.
Well, that's not what I'm talking about. My question is, do you think a film like this, once it's consumed by the general public, do you think it will make any change in the NFL?
I say no, because I don't think the film is going to do well at the box office. I don't think it's going to be. If it was this unbelievable film that was like seen by everybody, then maybe there would be. And as I said before, I think parents should watch this, and you know, before they just like suit their kids up in these, and you know, and go out and play in junior league football. But you know, and I think
for
the people,
you don't think they will.
I mean, I think the parents, people that see it, it might have some impact on them thinking twice about, you know, sending their kids. But I don't think a lot of people, I don't think the film's going to do well. Do you think the film's going to do well,
Jeffrey? Do you think it'll change the sport?
It's going to be okay.
I mean, Will Smith will bring in a certain, opening weekend numbers.
You don't think it'll change the sport at all? You don't think it'll change the sport or parents, how they raise their kids? You don't think it'll make any change?
I don't think it's going to have enough of an impact in general.
I think it'll start a conversation, but I mean, I can't imagine it having the kind of impact that some other important films have.
There's a great line in the movie where somebody says that the NFL owns a day of the week.
Yeah.
You know, and that the church used to own that day, and now that now the NFL owns that day. Mm-hmm. And there's such a powerful, I mean, America loves their football, you know, and
it's true.
And it's, I mean, if you go back, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the first Super Bowl, and when baseball was the national pastime, and you know, football has really become the national pastime. People are obsessed with football. Look at this fantasy football thing that's going on right now. People love this thing. So I don't think that there will. What could be the outcome of this? They're not going to stop playing football.
Maybe the
bigger helmets was the way to go. I don't know why they laughed.
I tend to agree. I mean, if you
Neil, there is something in the NFL now known as a concussion protocol that they've just started, and they seem to mention it an awful lot in the past few weeks during games. I think maybe the NFL is like, mention the concussion.
Yeah, maybe they're scared of this movie coming out.
Because if a player gets hit really hard and people see it, they will pull him out. He has to be checked out, that sort of thing. But there is that, which I don't think made the end credits of the movie. That was
the
weird
protocol
part.
Is not to show that on camera as much as possible. Keep that off camera.
Don't show that back in slow motion.
So, Jeffrey, let me ask you this. Out of the four movies that we discussed today, Joy, Concussion, The Hateful Eight, and The Revenant, do you think any of those are, in any category whatsoever, are sort of locked for Academy Awards?
Revenant is definitely locked.
Leo?
You think it'll be Best Picture?
For Best Picture, I think Best Director, certainly.
You think The Revenant is going to win Best Picture?
No, I don't think it's going to win.
No, I'm saying locked in any of the categories to win a particular.
Oh, the lock to win is Spotlight.
Yeah, I think Spotlight is the lock to win. And I think Leo is kind of a lock to win, unless Bryan Cranston.
And Lubezki, maybe his third Oscar in a row.
Do you think Bryan Cranston has a chance with the Trumbo? Because he's loved.
Maybe a nomination. But I mean, the movie is not, you know, it's a good HBO movie.
Yeah,
Johnny Depp has a chance.
Yeah, that's the conversation we were having.
Yeah.
You know, for those who don't know, and I'm glad you're asking about the awards, we are critics and work as entertainment reporters in various capacities, but Jeffrey and Hollywood Elsewhere makes his living for half of the year now as sort of an Oscar spitballer. And so
do you do Gold Derby, or you don't deal with
it? Yeah, he's part of the
Jeffrey
called Gold
Derby.
All right, so before we take off, I agree with you. I think Spotlight's a lock. We're going to, of course, have this discussion to death leading up to the Oscar. But
I was just going to say, check him out on Hollywood Elsewhere. And it's Hollywood-Elsewhere.com. But he also does a thing, so we're lucky to get him because he should be exclusive with Sasha Stone, called the Oscar Poker. And that's a podcast those guys do. And it's great. I listen to it every week. But
so you think Spotlight's a lock?
Yeah, give us the headlines. Where do you think, as we sit here in the last week of December-ish, leading up to the nominations haven't happened yet, but what do you think is what are the headlines besides Spotlight is Best Picture?
That the best film of early 16 is going to be Hail Caesar.
That's, oh yeah, have you seen that?
I've read it.
So this is, we should say, is the Coen brothers'
concept. It's a early 1950s Hollywood movie.
And why in the world are they releasing it in early January?
That's funny. It's actually February. And I thought that they would bring it out at the end of the year in a platform and then bring it out wide, you know, when everybody talks about how much fun it is.
This is the Coen brothers, we should say.
And I thought screwball movie about
George Clooney.
George Clooney and Josh Brolin. But Josh Brolin's really the lead, and it's about a movie star like Robert Taylor making a movie like Quo Vadis is kidnapped, and they have to deal with getting him back from the. And the great thing about it is that the kidnappers are communists, Jewish lefty communists, who are basically undermining the whole fabric of American life. They're doing exactly what the right said they were doing, and this is the joke of it. It's really hilarious. So.
All right, well, I think we've got. I think we're out of time. Are we out of time, Bill Bregoli?
Sure, if you say we are.
All right.
We are.
All right, well, thanks for sitting around talking movies with us today, and have a happy new year. Well, next year we'll be back. We'll talk about the movie that Jeffrey Wells recommended, since it's opening up in February, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And happy holidays and happy new year to everybody. It's for Jeffrey Wells, Bill McCuddy, Bill Bregoli, and Mike Sargent. Yes, Bill McCuddy is looking
at it. I was just going to mention, because this isn't long enough already, that, and by the way, we're going to, if you've listened to this to this point, you know we had an overture at the beginning and an intermission in the middle. But we should say that next week's show on television on City,
yes,
is our week, year's best, and we pick the best,
yes,
and worst.
Please watch Talking Pictures on Demand again locally in New York One if you're in New York City, and nationally on Time Warner Cable. It is our annual best of best worst show, and we pick tell you not only the best of what's on demand for the entire year, we tell you the worst of what was on demand. We have categories and runners up, and we tell you the best performances, the worst performances, and we have a lot of wacky categories.
Spoiler alert, I love Love and Mercy, which I know Jeffrey Wells is a huge fan of, and that's all I'll say.
So watch that, and thanks again for sitting around talking pictures with us.
And thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.